Welcome everyone to the Caribbean Science Fiction Network, a celebration of all things fantasy, folklore, speculative fiction, and of course, science fiction. Today I have with me Jamaican-American Christopher Farley, or CJ Farley.
That's one reason why I created Game World, because I thought Jamaica and the Caribbean is such a vibrant culture there, such rich history, such a rich myths to draw from.
We'll be talking about his 2014 novel, Game World.
And that's what I tried to do in every page of Game World, where yes, it's escapist, yes, it's fun, yes, there are a lot of puns and wordplay and monsters, but there are also some real ideas there too that wouldn't have come, I think, from other authors who weren't part of the Jamaican diaspora that I tried to represent in the plot of the book.
Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. If only this podcast had been around when I was in middle school or younger, because it was hard to imagine then having a whole show devoted to Caribbean-themed fiction or Caribbean-themed sci-fi and fantasy. Yeah. But now it's happening, and I'm glad to be here.
No better time than now. this book has been published a while now, but I still think it's not only pertinent to the podcast, but also something that it just deserves discussion even today. So for those who haven't read it, talk us through the novel. Give us a synopsis.
Yeah, well, Game World is a fantasy adventure novel with some sci-fi elements about a group of kids who find out this video game that they love is actually the portal to this fantasy world, this Caribbean-themed fantasy world, where they go on an adventure. And one reason I wrote it is because, you know, I loved reading J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and books like that when I was a kid. But I also understood that usually people of color were not part of the narrative. You know, Tolkien, you read about, you know, those kinds of books always talk about the Dark Lord this, Dark Lord that, and the Dark Lord is always someone who was very, very evil and probably wasn't even necessarily all that dark. And so I thought, I want to create my own kind of fantasy universe that draws on Caribbean myth and features characters that are diverse and some of whom have Caribbean background. So that's kind of what Game World is about, and that's the origin for it. And I want to write a book that people could have a lot of fun reading as well.
Let's talk about something a bit more specific in the novel, and I'm referring to the changes. What about them appealed to you, or how did you why did you find it necessary to talk about changes in this way?
Again, one reason why I wrote the book is it's funny that people think of British culture as something that has a huge long history and that overshadows sometimes other parts of the world because they used to be an empire. But Tolkien created his world in part because he felt intimidated by the mythologies of other countries. He felt that he wanted to create a sort of homegrown kind of British mythology that could stand beside stuff out of Scandinavia or Germany. And that's one reason why I created Game World, because I thought, you know, this Jamaica and the Caribbean is such a vibrant culture there, such rich history, such rich myths to draw from. Why can't we have our own fantasy adventure saga? Why can't we have some sort of journey, some sort of adventure that name checks and explores some of the kinds of creatures and myths that I heard about growing up, everything from duppies to pirates and more. And so that's one reason why I wrote the book and populated it with some of the things that I did, because just like Tolkien, I wanted to celebrate and explore and mythologize some of the great myths that I had heard growing up that I felt the whole world would have fun hearing about.
I want to pick up on something that the Wall Street Journal described your book. They described it as the Narnia for the social media generation. And I found that because allegory is so central to Narnia, I wanted to know if you see Game World as allegorical and in what ways do you think it can be allegorical?
Well, that's a great question because, of course, you know, C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien were great friends. They were in a group called the Inklings together. But they had very sharp divergence of opinion when it came to whether good fiction should be allegorical. Tolkien hated when people reduced The Lord of the Rings to an allegory, or when people thought that the ring, the One Ring, stood for like nuclear power or something like that, because that's not how he ultimately saw his work. He thought that was too reductive. C.S. Lewis, when you read his work, clearly he is trying to communicate some ideas that he had about faith and about specifically Christianity through his plot and through some of the characters that he chooses. I myself think it's a great idea to have fiction sort of stand on its own, to occupy its own kind of imaginative space. But I'm okay if people want to read in things that they see into the work and see things and say, oh, could that be an allegory for this? Could that stand for that? But as an author, I don't go around sort of saying this means that, that means that, because if I could reduce this work to one sentence, I would have tweeted it out. I wouldn't have written the whole book. I just would have put something on Facebook or on Instagram or sent a long tweet out there and hashtagged it, and that's that. Part of the beauty of literature is that it changes, that it doesn't just have one interpretation, that it is a big thing that you can explore again and again. You know, just the other day, I sort of reread The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe by C.S. Lewis, and I was surprised that even though I knew the plot, because I'd read it many times in the past, how you see different things in it as an adult than I saw when I was a kid. And that's the side of a great work where it changes with you. You see different things. It's not just one reductive statement. It's many things over time. And I tried to write Game World to be a book like that, where I think that, you know, middle grade readers can enjoy it on one level, high schoolers can enjoy another, and adults, I think, can appreciate some of the other things going on in it and some of the themes and the thematic ties that are buried beneath the surface.
Of course, we have to talk about the video games, the video game world, right, which coming from that title, but blending it with Jamaican folklore culture. So talk to us about how your journey towards blending these two seemingly different elements, video games and folklore.
Well, here's the interesting thing. Now, I was born in Kingston, Jamaica, but I grew up in Brockport, New York, which is a small town. It's a suburb of Rochester, New York, which is a small city. And my parents taught at the State University of New York at Brockport. My mom was the chairman of the African American Studies Department. My dad was the chairman of the Economics Department. But there's not a whole lot to do in Brockport. And so when my friends and I wanted to have some fun, we would drive into Rochester and we would go to the video game parlors and play video games. And it was a great way to escape, to do something different, to journey to another world. So I don't see a huge gap between the world of video games, which is essentially escapist, and the world of fantasy fiction. Because as a kid, both venues, both science fiction and both video games and sci-fi and fantasy books were portals that I would use to go to other places that were beyond upstate New York. So I don't see them as different places. I also think that they connect in terms of world building. I know the difficulty it takes to put together a really great video game, to make sure it feels authentic, to make sure it feels like something you want to explore over time to get to different kind of levels. The same thing is true when you're trying to create a great book. It takes a fantasy book. It takes a lot of world building, figuring out, okay, what are the languages? What's the culture? What are the rules? What does the landscape look like? There's a lot of great world building that goes on. And I think it's really important for creators of color to build those worlds. I mean, there are a lot of worlds out there in literature, you know, everything from like, you know, the land of Conan the Sumerian to Neverland. But there are fewer worlds that are created by Black folks, by people of color. And I think that because other readers out there have these escape lands they can go to and travel to their imaginations, we deserve the same kind of places. And also, I think it's good for readers who aren't of color to be able to travel to these lands that were created by people of color to sort of see what's inside of our imaginations, and perhaps it will affect them in some sort of deep kinds of ways. And I also feel that a lot of these, when someone creates a world that's that really works, it can be as real as the real world. I mean, I think that when I read the first five books of George R. R. Martin's Game of Thrones, and then saw the TV show, the world of Westeros seemed to me as real as many real places that you see on the map, because it was that detailed. You know, you think of the Lord of the Rings. That feels to me as real as, I'm sure many people, as New Zealand, which is probably why when Peter Jackson made the films, he set it there and cast a lot of his friends from Australia and New Zealand, because the interconnection was so tight. It felt so real to him. He made it a real landscape in his real world. So I think building worlds that feel real, you can travel to, whether it's in video games or whether it's in books, it is vitally important to, I think, expanding the landscape of our imaginations.
By infusing this book with video games, what kind of research you did on video games? I'm just curious.
Yeah, well, you know, I always think that research, because I come from the world of journalism. And I was a former music critic at Time Magazine, a former senior editor at Time, and a former senior editor at the Wall Street Journal. And so I spent a lot of my career, you know, writing stories and reporting on stories and calling people up and checking sources and editing stories. And so I try to bring the discipline of research to the work that I do. But in the end, when you're writing an imaginative work, you do all the research you can, and then you throw stuff out and make things up, because that's what you're supposed to do as an imaginative novelist. Now, the key thing is, through research, you can learn what the guardrails are and realize that, okay, if I do that, people won't believe it. If I do that, that's something that doesn't happen. Or here's a real story that I can weave into the plot to make the stuff I'm making up seem more real. So that's what my research consisted of, is, you know, really, you know, talking to my son and his friends about their video game experiences, watching them in action, playing some of these games myself, and then going beyond that to create a wholly imagined game and a wholly imagined space for this book. So a lot of research, a lot of making stuff up.
The game that we're referring to, role-playing fantasy game, but it's played in I don't know how I'm pronouncing this, Jamaica, with an X, right? And I wanted to pick up on this spelling because based on a little bit of research that I did, it's very close to the indigenous spelling of the country. Was this, how did you arrive at this? Was it intentional? And, you know, what were you trying to get at with the use of the indigenous term?
Well, you know, everything in the book is intentional except for the stuff that's not. And again, you talked about research. That's part of the research that I did, because I did a lot of research into magic in Jamaica, into the cultural and socio-political history of Jamaica, to weave it into my narrative in ways that were interesting and fun, and find out, you know, creatures that maybe hadn't gotten a whole lot of attention that were part of the mythology of Jamaica, name places that I thought would have some resonance that I wanted to weave into the plot of what I was talking about. And so that's all part of, I think, the fun of the book. And I think that, you know, again, some middle grade readers, maybe they'll pick up on that. Maybe they won't. I often find that sometimes the smaller kids are the ones that pick up on that kind of stuff the most, because they're the ones that will, you know, hit Wikipedia hard and start looking stuff up and checking into things, saying, is that real? Is that real? What does that mean? Where does that come from? Is there a larger meaning there? And that's always fun to see when people really begin to analyze things and try to figure out if there are larger meanings beyond the surface meanings they may have gotten on their first read.
So we've talked about a little bit about the games. Let's talk about the folklore. And I've interviewed quite a few writers already, and they all bring this unique sort of aspect to folklore. And I want to get from you, what is different about these particular folklore characters, but also historical figures, right? So there's Nani, that major historical figure that led slave rebellion. So talk to us about your own specific folklore characters and how you were using them to fit your exploration of culture in the novel.
Well, I'm always fascinated when people are able to sort of take real spaces and infuse them with myth and meaning, and sort of both uplift where they come from and make other people interested in where they come from because of it. And I mentioned before that I used to work as a journalist and music critic. And so as a music critic, I interviewed all sorts of people, and everyone from Aretha Franklin to, you know, Radiohead to Jay-Z. But I remember once I did an interview with Bruce Springsteen, and he invited me up to his house in New Jersey. And he had a lot of stories to tell about New Jersey. And what I loved about his music and loved about his attitude is that, you know, of course, there's some people out there that make fun of New Jersey. They shouldn't, because it's a great place, but it's a butt of a lot of jokes. But instead of running from, you know, his title of one of his most famous songs is Born to Run. Instead of running from his past, he embraced it. He infused New Jersey, a place that's sometimes the butt of unfair jokes, with kind of myth and meaning with every song. And when you hear a Bruce Springsteen album, you're like, I want to go to New Jersey. I want to hang out at that same amusement park. I want to roar down the same roads that Bruce was roaring down. And I wanted to do the same thing for Jamaica. I wanted to take this place that people maybe know from tourism commercials, that maybe they visited there a couple times, and really dig deep into the earth and talk about some of the myths and some of the heroes of Jamaican history and weave them into the narrative. And one of those was Nani of the Maroons, who, of course, is a national hero of Jamaica. And Jamaicans know her. They know her from being on the currency as well. But she's not known as much as she should be outside the country. And she's such a legendary and fascinating figure, this woman who led armies, who maybe worked magic, who fought the British to a standstill for years. Just a fascinating character. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool to make her part of my narrative, to create a character that is based on her and represents some of the things that she represented. And it would be just a strong grounding for a character and for a book. And I did that a number of times in the book, but that was one of the characters that really is drawn up straight from Jamaican myth. And it was a fun thing to do. I did a lot of research on her. And then, of course, I made it all up to sort of fit the narrative.
any character in this novel, you kind of either you either struggled with the most or you were proud of the most. Any character that stands out?
Yeah, well, I'm really happy with all the characters, because one thing I wanted to do is the world of literature, and particularly children's books, and by that I mean books that are fantasy adventure books, is incredibly white. It may not seem that way, isn't it? When you look at the when you sort of view it anecdotally, you're like, yeah, we know lots of black authors out there, but when you look at the hard and fast numbers of how many books get published each year, the number of fantasy and science fiction books that are written by black people is incredibly small, and way smaller than our representation in the population. And that's a real problem, because what happens is a lot of kids grow up reading fantasy and science fiction and fantasy books, and they never encounter black characters, or they never encounter themes that deal with people of color. And they never enter the minds of people in color, which a book allows you to do. And I think it's bad for people who aren't of color, who have such a limited worldview. And it's bad for people of color growing up to not be able to experience their own points of view in the fantasy and adventure and science fiction books that they read. So it was important for me to write the book for that reason, because I wanted to give people the options that I sometimes didn't have as a kid, to have fantasy, sci-fi and fantasy books that have black characters in them. And it's important not just to have characters of color, because these days, one of the things a lot of people do is they'll have a character of color in a sci-fi film or a TV series, which is great, but then they will not grapple with ideas and perspectives that maybe real people of color actually have. And that reminds me of, because there's precedent for this that people don't really haven't learned from what they should. One of my favorite sci-fi stories was a story by W.E. Du Bois, the guy who wrote The Souls of Black Folks back in 1920. He wrote a short story called The Comet. Have you read the story? It's a great story, because, obviously W.E. Du Bois is known as a great political philosopher and social activist. But he wrote this side fiction story about a comet that is coming to New York, and this one black guy, is in the basement or otherwise hidden away when it comes. When he comes back out, he realizes the comet has destroyed New York and everybody's dead. And he wanders around, and the only person, other person who seems to survive is a white woman. And they look around, they realize the last two people on Earth. And they maybe will have to repopulate the earth by themselves, just this black guy and this white woman who's from a rich family. And of course, 1920, that's a pretty subversive theme, interracial relationships, interracial love in New York City. And there's some other things that happen in the plot, but I don't want to tell you the whole thing, give it away. But it's a really fascinating story. It's very short. You can find it on the web or on Amazon. And what I love about it is that it's not just populating a sci-fi story with a black character, it's also engaging in issues that are of interest to black people as well, and not in a kind of crass, overt kind of way. And that's a challenge, I think, for all sci-fi writers, and especially writers of color, to not only represent us with the characters, but also represent us with the ideas. Now, every short story, every book by a black author doesn't have to be about, race overtly, or racism overtly, or police brutality overtly, but it should come with a perspective that represents your ideas in a real way, represents your culture in a real way. And that's what I tried to do in every page of Game World, where yes, it's escapist, yes, it's fun, yes, there are a lot of puns and wordplay and monsters, but there are also some real ideas there too that wouldn't have come, I think, from other authors who weren't part of the Jamaican diaspora that I tried to represent in the plot of the book.
We're coming down to the end of the chat, but one thing last thing I had to ask you was, this novel, Game World, it's different from your others. So why video games? Why this novel? How did it? What was the And what was the impetus? How did this originate?
I remember reading when I was at the Wall Street Journal, I remember I read an article which quoted Toni Morrison as being so surprised when Barack Obama became president, because she thought, you know, in all my fiction, I couldn't have imagined a black president. She said something, I'm paraphrasing, but she said something along those lines. And I love Toni Morrison, but it struck me because I thought, that's the important task of, I think, of writers, to imagine new worlds and new possibilities and new things. So then sometimes the real world can catch up to us. And that's why I think that fantasy writing and sci-fi writing is so important. I mean, you have someone like Arthur C. Clarke imagining satellites before they're actually real satellites up there in orbit. And as a sci-fi fantasy writer, I thought it was very important to imagine these new worlds, because I think it helps push the whole world forward. It helps kids who are reading it to think, oh, I can imagine more than just stories that are just set in the real world. I can imagine things beyond that, and perhaps the world will reach there in the real world as well. So one reason why I was drawn, again, so deeply to writing a book about this fantasy and sci-fi is because I wanted to push the boundaries of imagination. At one point in the book, there's someone who quotes Pablo Picasso as saying, if you can imagine it, it can be real. Paraphrasing again. And that's such a powerful sentiment that if you can imagine, I think you can make it real. But first, you really have to work the imagination. You have to push its boundaries. You have to be able to imagine crazy new things. Yeah. And then maybe in the real world, you can make those crazy new things actually happen. So I think fantasy works far from being things that are just sort of, you know, silly or just superfluous. They really do some real work in terms of pushing out the boundaries of our brain. And one other thing I want to mention too, I recently went to a great exhibit in New York with for Jean-Michel Basquiat, King Pleasure. Everyone should see it. It's curated by his two surviving sisters. It's a great show. But they had some of his journals. It was just sort of fascinating to see this young kid, the Basquiat was then, you know, doing all these crazy drawings, thinking all these crazy things he wanted to say. And now a Basquiat painting that back in 2017 sold for $110 million, the most expensive painting ever at auction for an American painter. So you can start off with a silly imagination as a kid. You can imagine fantasy things, and it can be something real that changes the landscape of American art. That's why I wrote Game World, to really show that imagination is king, imagination is important, and anyone who reads it might be the next Basquiat if they can only exercise their imagination enough.
Well, CJ, Chris, it's been really good talking about this novel, Game World. But before I let you go, anything else you want to leave us with, or our listeners?
Yeah, one thing that really influenced me in writing this book is music. I mean, I listened to a lot of reggae and hip hop as I was writing this book. I'm very much influenced by all the performers that I've interviewed, everyone from like Bunny Wailer and Ziggy Marley to Lauryn Hill. And I still remember I once did a cover story on Lauryn Hill for Time magazine. I remember when I went to interviewing her, and we started in the afternoon, and it went to dark, and I remember the lights all, she didn't have any lights on, and so pretty soon we were sitting in the dark, and she was just talking. And I still can sort of hear her voice in my head, just sort of talking in the dark, and just how all the things she was talking about were just so inspirational to me in terms of the way she was sort of breaking the boundaries of hip-hop and trying to channel Jamaican culture and reggae into the work that she was doing, and coming up with this union that no one else had really done, and that eventually became this massive breakthrough when the album came out, because I was talking to her before she released her first solo album. And that voice, you know, the Lauryn Hill's voice in the darkness is kind of what helped inspire this book. Just, I hope that the kids that read it, and for the adults that read it, that it is kind of that voice in the darkness that inspires them to in their imagination, or just entertains them. So I think back to that moment.
I like that. I like that so much. Well, Chris, it's been really good having you. Thank you so much for taking time out of your writing schedule to chat with me and indulge me in my podcast. So thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And continue to stay tuned to the Caribbean Science Fiction Network. Bye.